Jack Bohannon isn't a typical relationship coach.
Rather than the relationship with mother, it's how society structures around.
He's here to unravel the inner war that many men never talk about.
Our base needs and instincts are no longer acknowledged.
The fear of intimacy, the confusion around masculinity, and the unspoken trauma that echoes through their relationships.
There are ways that we qualify our partners in society that we just don't talk about.
This is not a conversation about dating. It's a conversation about healing.
Jack, welcome so much to The Global Affair. I've been really looking forward to hosting you and this conversation on what is gender. And I feel like, you know, we're having this conversation a little after the wave of, in some ways, mania around this conversation. And I think that that's actually really nice timing to be able to, even just in retrospect, think about how much that conversation around what is gender grew, say, between 2020 and probably recently. So I'd love to include that in our conversation, but I know you've had extensive experience traveling the world, understanding what gender is across culture. And I really just wanted to, you know, ask, before we jump into all of those details, what was the impetus that made you want to dive so deeply into this subject matter?
It was Daniela. Daniela did it. I met this woman who's this fantastically feminine creature, and we had this tremendous first date where the sky parted and lightning struck both of us, and she had some sort of wild spiritual woman trance happen. Like, okay, what the heck is that? And oh my God, can we put it in a bottle and sell it? Because what has happened to this wild energy that she exhibits so freely and is just repressed or suppressed in the rest of the world? So as someone who is really progressively minded, going on this date and having this experience with her of strong gender polarity, so to speak, and watching lightning come up my spine as I see her in this trance where she's falling down in a puddle, giggling and won't stand up, loses her short-term memory. It was like this wild, love-struck moment. So that really piqued my curiosity about what happens thematically for men and women who are connecting across like a heterosexual divide, that there's something powerful there that may be lost in current progressive thinking about gender theory. And I deeply, dearly insist on the inclusion of everyone. It's not this strict role play where one person's doing one thing and the other's doing the other. It's not that we need to be so strict or limited. And it is a charged conversation, like you said. It's so easy to misinterpret and to express some nuance in our understanding and to just be torpedoed for it. Because everyone believes one thing and one set of beliefs or another. So it's really easily mistaken if you're expressing something in the middle.
I think I love that this was actually your inspiration, this deep personal experience of, say, masculine, feminine polarity. And by the sounds of it, meeting a woman that you fell in love with pretty quickly that maybe gave you an experience of masculinity that you hadn't had before. And just how powerful that is, how much that unlocked within you. I just think that it's cool that was the motivation to go on this deeper exploration and maybe not the reaction to a world in some ways going mad over this conversation. And yeah. I'm curious, you know, you had this personal initiation and the world was simultaneously putting this as kind of like, you know, front and center conversation. How was that for you? Like, how did you place yourself in the context of how the world was discussing gender theory?
It didn't fit at all. So reconciling this one experience and these truths that felt important, that a lot of people are asserting about masculinity and femininity, it didn't fit whatsoever with a homogenized view of humanity that downplayed our biological differences or what was thematic based on our biological makeups as men and women. That's not to exclude anyone who doesn't fit a heteronormative frame. But there's really something there that's important to how a lot of people connect, and it's not that sensible right now. It's not something that you can perceive too easily, because we are pretty similar in how we go about our day-to-day life, and there isn't that much...
Men and women?
Yeah, there isn't that much cause in our current society for any type of segregation.
Yeah, as opposed to kind of historically where the men had a very strict and specific role and the women had a very strict and specific role.
Yeah, and after interviewing dozens of people across cultures and just listening to what their experience is and basically not speaking in return, I've come to think privately in my own mind that maternity plays a huge role in how we form gender roles.
The relationship with mother.
Rather than the relationship with mother, it's how society structures around the event of motherhood. So in a society where we're living to the age of 30 on average, and basic needs are a huge concern, it really matters that a woman is pregnant for 9 months and then that this child has dependency on her for 2 years. That's a big structural role for female-bodied people. And it doesn't matter as much now. It's not as impactful because there isn't as much mortality during childbirth. There isn't as much emphasis on manual labor. And a woman can be giving birth and then back on the job 2 weeks later as a high-power corporate attorney. So that's a big change compared to a time when, like, frostbite was a bigger concern. So in this era where we are so equal in so many ways, we've evolved to this point where physical strength doesn't matter that much. Maternity is not that much, not as taxing as it was at one time. That changes things structurally for how we're identifying ourselves as men and women.
I really agree. You know, I find myself contemplating many of these same things, and even, you know, I find myself thinking a lot about the fertility issues that our generation, you know, say people under sort of 35 are experiencing. It's the least fertile men and women have ever been. We're having less babies than we've ever had. And I mean, I look at that and I sort of also see it through a bit of an evolutionary lens, that our societal structures, our lifestyle, our perception of masculinity and femininity has become, well, has come to this place where we're not having as much sex, we're not having as many children. And, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, that seems like we're moving maybe in, you know, in a bit of a weird direction. And on top of that, it's become sort of a controversial thing to put forward, which I think is the even craziest part about this, that, like, to say, yes, as a species, we should be having children, we should be encouraging, you know, these forms of connection because our future literally depends on it. That's become like a, you know, elitist thing to think and say, I think is, you know, where do you go with that? It's like postmodernism put on steroids to this place of, in some ways, I think, just insanity, where we've lost the basic kind of connection to objective kind of truths, which I think has implications more broadly on our society, our ability to critically think, our ability to have a sense of place in the world. Like, if we don't have these truths to come back to, then what we're replacing that with is our subjective opinion about something, and we can never find a place of agreement, which I think is very dangerous for a complex world. We need, as a species, things to come back to and kind of lean on and rely on as a foundation for our lives.
Interesting. I think I'm following you in large part, and I'm wondering if you have an example of some of those objective truths.
So, for example, you know, the what it means biologically to be a male, what it means biologically to be a female, and to be okay with that and to not feel like we need to adapt that or change that, how that then feeds into, I think, specifically men's feeling of belonging and relevance in society. But in many ways, I think women are not actually happy within these constructs. But that's also a controversial thing to say, because a lot of women will say, oh, well, that's, you know, not standing up for true feminism. But I see it, you know, in my own circles, women that don't have a space to really own the things that maybe they innately and biologically want as women tend to end up unhappier.
Progressivism frustrates me. Yeah, thank you for saying all that. I'm so in line with the values of progressivism around environmental stewardship, freedom mm-hmm. of this, freedom of that, individualism. And there are some new messages that are limiting in that, or that we need to be all or none in any mm-hmm. of those, any of those areas of believing all these things at once or not. And I've heard the same thing of women's frustration with feminism, that any expression of traditional femininity, as we all kind of understand it, as like 1950s femininity, mm-hmm. is for chumps. Femininity is for chumps. So that puts people in a difficult place when they look to their biology and they're wanting to express themselves in one way, and then they're, the moral overtones of leading thought is to do otherwise. So that's a new type of social expectation that's created by thought of the last 50 years or so. So then, we're not making babies anymore. That's crazy. Like, we're making way fewer babies. I hadn't even thought about that.
Yeah.
So there's a move away from something that's biologically essential. Maybe we're selecting ourselves out as a species. I don't know. We're just going to
I hope not. Yeah, well, it's also, you know, it's like people will say that we have an overpopulated world, but many countries in the world right now are actually reproducing under the rate of replenishing generations. Japan in particular, but also in the United States, and fertility is just getting worse and worse. And obviously there's other factors to this, including, you know, nutrition and whatever kind of interventions that we're experiencing physiologically that play a role in that. And I'm curious, you know, to hear your perspective on if you feel the move away from traditional gender roles has been influenced by these other things. For example, you know, high levels of estrogen in our food and our water that's killing male testosterone, or if you kind of feel like all of it is ideological and cultural.
I think it's technological as much as anything, that there's something about how we've structured our work environment and how technology has advanced in the last 200 years, that we're not as differentiated as men or women. So if you look at some of the statistics for how women experience relationship in general, they're far better off single. They
really?
Are, yeah, yeah. Their life expectancy, their quality of life,
life expectancy without life, a husband,
jacking up with a man and having kids has not historically benefited women for a variety of reasons. But yeah, a lot of the metrics of quality of life are lower for women who are coupled with a man and shackled with kids. So they're simply choosing not to do that, and they have the power because the means to generate income is not based on physical strength. They're not dependent on men. Yeah. So they're choosing to do something different. I think that's part of it. Yeah, there's a lot of plastic floating around in the oceans and my blood. So that's probably not helping things. Yeah, and I don't see it as an ideological push that prevents child. I don't see it as an ideological push that is limiting our fertility or reproduction rates exactly. I think we're going to keep having sex regardless. Maybe some young people feel that they can't responsibly have a kid because they're not in a financial position to do so. And yeah, I've heard that the Gen Z is not having as much sex as they
think about the forms of interaction, you know, even the resilience to go and ask someone out and be rejected, you know, the fragility of being protected from confrontation, like true physical confrontation, looking someone in the eye, having a conversation, picking up the phone, like these skills are becoming less and less as technology is on the acceleration curve. And I think that also plays a huge role. You know, it's very important for men's character development and also women's character development to learn how to deal with the ambiguity of connection, of dating, of feeling insecure and having to sort of like bear with that. You know, there's so many barriers now that we put between needing to feel uncomfortable in those ways that it's no surprise that younger generations are not having as much sex, you know, in those ways, because, you know, the traditional male's journey to have sex, especially as a virgin, is to get rejected a lot, you know, and to have to go through that, to actually have to be initiated through that process.
That's a beautiful moment to get up and walk across a cafe and not know what's going to happen. Like, oh, what am I going to say when I get over there? This is going to be awkward. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great to have that kind of connection and spontaneity. And we are stuck behind screens.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big way we disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
Huge. And
but, you know, to connect.
What's that?
Disguised as connection, which I think is the difficult thing.
Yeah. Get a bunch of likes, but no sincere connection.
Mm. Yeah. So this is an interesting perspective, which I also agree with in part. The blurring of lines between day-to-day responsibilities and the lives of men and women have become closer than they have further apart. So in your journeys kind of around the world to have conversations, I'm interested specifically too in maybe less developed countries and cultures. When I say less developed, I mean by Western standards, that are maybe still more dependent on a traditional gender role for men and women. What have you discovered in that? What has sort of become, what's been illuminated for you through those processes?
Not surprisingly, the more money people have, the more options they have.
Mm-hmm.
So in Vietnam, they have a tradition of marriage kidnapping, where basically you can grab a woman off the street in rural Vietnam and marry her. And they're needing to provide some money to the family.
Mm-hmm.
There's some like restitution basically to the family, which is crazy. But if that family already has money, they can avoid that circumstance. So they're almost selling their daughter to the lowest bidder. Whereas if they have a lot of money, that's not the case. And she has more free will as well she should. Mm. So money correlates with more opportunity and ultimately more homogeny if women have more options, which I absolutely believe they should. And as things progress into the West, as we become more developed, and as we are now in the United States, people feel a quagmire in relationships. Mm-hmm. And men feel a frustration that they are competing with women and then also not respected as men. So it's like there's some sort of social role gap that's not currently satisfied there. So it's interesting to watch how our gender and our social roles meet various needs. So we start off meeting, we're way low on Maslow's hierarchy to begin with, where it's food, water, shelter. Mm-hmm. And we're doing a very different type of gender expression at that point. Mm-hmm. Versus when we're in the United States or Australia.
Right.
Yeah, exactly, in the West. And we're basically seeking esteem needs. We're competing for self-esteem through external validation. Mm-hmm. That we have what we need. We can procreate, eat, hang out with our friends.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that we're doing now is really about esteem. And it sets a very different tone than somebody who's scrambling to keep their belly full.
That's really interesting perspective. So do you feel from these observations that the sort of progressive evolution of gender, i.e., you know, the society getting to this place where there's almost a breaking down of even acknowledging the differences between men and women, more of a social acceptance of gender-neutral, you know, ideas, that's actually a result of becoming extremely comfortable societally, and kind of in the process of that comfort being removed from the kind of innate way of existing.
Interesting question. And yes, it's a decadent problem to be having. It's a decadent thing to be talking about gender through microphones through several thousand miles away. Like, we have awesome problems. This is so cool. Yeah, and there's a move away naturally in that from what's essentially animal and biologically driven in a very immediate way in terms of food and sex. They're way down there on the pyramid. So what's maddening about some of the progressive overlay that's happened is that for the majority of people, our base needs and instincts are no longer acknowledged as being important. We're supposed to be compassionate, kind, urbane, and carry on in this way as sophisticated people. But what we're really wanting is just to fuck. We just want to, like, I don't know if I can say that here. But yeah, there's all this primal driver where there are ways that we qualify our partners in society that we just don't talk about. And we should.
Because it's not kosher.
Because it feels unfair. I'm 6'2", and wow, does that work to my advantage. And there are all sorts of ways that men qualify women based on what we are attracted to, which is driven by base needs, by needs to procreate. There's all this animal beneath the surface of progressivism, and then to receive the message that the way to operate in society is to be kind and communicative and open and vulnerable as a man is disabling, because she's still into the guy on the motorcycle. There's still a lot to be said for the guy on the motorcycle for a lot of people.
So many kind of parts of this I want to dive into, but I guess sort of the burning question as I hear you share that is, based on everything that you've explored in this conversation, what conclusions have you drawn around the antidote for some of these conditions that, you know, we've found ourselves in societally? Like, do you think the answer in this is to go back to more traditional definitions of how a female spends her day versus how a male spends her day? Or how do we bring kind of what's innate and primal into what's become a sophisticated and complex society? And is that possible?
We don't really know what's going to happen in the future. We don't know what the next conception of a man or a woman is going to be. I think the best thing that we can be right now is authentic to ourselves and to not absorb a lot of those messages. So there's something in being authentic. Like, I am the modern definition of man, whatever that's supposed to be. And it's my flavor, and that's my fullest truth. That's what I can bring. And there are some ways where all of our biological needs being met, that we can re-manifest some of those primal goals or primal drives. If we're talking heteronormative relationships and a role for men that's satisfying for them and satisfying for women, can return to protector mode in some ways, but it's happening on an emotional level where guys can manage their own emotionality and they can manage a conversation well. They can attend to their partner in a certain way. There's all sorts of ways where it feels fantastic for a woman to have a man hold space like that. So again, that's a decadent problem. That's like a higher level problem than making some heroic lift of a rock that saves everyone, or being the one who's uniquely capable of providing food, which was actually never the case. There, a lot of our evolutionary thinking about gender is really not factual. It's just that. It's thinking. So there are some ways that I see people being able to embody that gender dynamics. There are some ways I see people being able to embody the gender differentiation that's really satisfying, even as we all just code software, even as we don't really have reason for that differentiation based on gender aligned with biological sex.
Yeah, and there are differences. I mean, you know, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm the founder and CEO of a tech startup. You know, you could look at it from the outside and say that's a very masculine role. It's a very male-dominated space. I have to, you know, deal with men constantly. But I know the way I lead is more feminine than if it was a male founder of this company, a male CEO of this company. I believe that there would be major differences in how they approach the product, how they lead and grow the team, how they pitch to investors. And, you know, you see these biases. Like, I think venture capital is an interesting kind of echo chamber of what we're talking about, because only 0.8% of venture capital goes to women in the West. And yet, as kind of the anomaly, I know that I haven't necessarily had to yield to kind of an expectation of what the Ivy League male dropout in Silicon Valley looks like and sounds like and talks like. I've been able to stay authentically me in that process. But, you know, on the other hand, if I was born 500 years ago, my life as a woman would look very different.
I'm thinking about how it would look different.
Well, I wouldn't be the CEO of a tech startup. Because AI didn't exist then. But also, you know, for all the reasons that you mentioned, a female 500 years ago was not going to be the person put in charge of a company, of finances, of, you know, also. And I think that this problem still stands, although it is changing. There's still a big difference between male financial literacy and female financial literacy, even in the West.
How does your leadership benefit from whatever you conceive of as your womanness? What do you bring based on that?
It's interesting because I think it's sort of like it can be perceived as a double-edged sword. So, like, I'm really curious about the funding divide, because I really believe I look at it from the point of view of, if we don't have diverse perspectives building artificial intelligence right now, then we're building a super intelligence that reflects a very small section of humanity. And there's big issues with that, because I believe that at one point we're basically going to have to hand all of our governance over to technology like this. So we need to make sure that there's diversification and adequate polarities, you know, in its design, in order to really maintain the integrity of what it means to be human and to have our society. So from that perspective, I care deeply about this. But venture capitalists will always say, well, you know, women won't sell a dream as big as the men that come in and pitch. But when you actually look at the data, what the data says about female-led startups and male-led startups is men are more likely to overpromise and underdeliver. And women are more likely to underpromise and overdeliver. So they're more conservative and maybe, you know, modest in their promise, but they'll actually be more consistent and thorough and deliver in the long term. And actually, the statistics show that women-led startups actually generally do better when they're given the chance.
Nice. You should start your pitch with that, for sure.
Yeah, I don't like getting into the gender debate in some of these rooms, but like building
at the beginning
a good
of your pitch.
Yeah. Oh, but God, you know, no. That I guess what I'm trying to sort of think out loud about here is, you can still be a female in a very male dominated space and performing functions that maybe historically would have been exclusively male, but still have something in your innate design that makes a difference in the way that you lead, in the way that you ideate. And I definitely know that to be true. I don't think I would have developed this product the same if I wasn't a female.
I imagine. Yeah. And those roles aren't as strict as they those roles aren't as strict as we think them to be, even historically. And there's a statistic that really caught me, and that's that women hunted in 79% of hunter-gatherer societies. So the evolutionary narrative is that, like, men protect, provide, women gather, blah, blah, blah. Mm. So even in that, even in our conception of the long ago, we're confirming some of the things that were just recent.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot of cause for overlap. But then, like, if that statistic is taken as a win by progressivism and feminists that, like, contradict a hard reality, the other thing to look at is that in 20% of those societies, men did all the hunting. And in 0% of those societies, did women do all of the hunting.
Mm.
So it's like we tend to think in black and white around
right.
these roles. And oftentimes, it's what's thematic, it's large overlap in role play. And it's still really important and interesting to look at what's thematic and how female leadership is different than male leadership in the year 2025.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting point. So is what you conclude from learning that, that it isn't black and white, but there is still a tilt towards men being providers. Like, it's there's statistically a tilt towards it, but it's not like men have to be the providers and women have to be the ones looking after the babies. It's there is nuance to it, but there's a leaning towards one or the other, which I guess is kind of what I'm reflecting in my own experience, that I'm living in a very male-dominated context, but I know that there's something that is uniquely feminine about the way that I'm building this company that I don't think that I could actually divorce myself from. Do you know, like, even if I was in the mind of, like, I'm a mega feminist and, you know, women rule the world and I don't need a man, like, I don't think any of those things. I have incredible men in my life. I have incredible men in my company that have strengths that I don't have, and the company would not be what it is if I didn't have that support from the men in my life and the men on my team and the men on my cap table. And I have no issue or ego acknowledging that. I don't know, you know, why many women and men have issues acknowledging, I guess, you know, they've been hurt by men in their lives and men have been hurt by many women in their lives. It makes it difficult to acknowledge the role that each of us play in each other's story and journey and working to each other's strengths.
Yeah, we shut down to the opposite gender a lot of the time for various reasons. And my actual career is working as a relationship coach, and I work mostly with women around reconditioning experiences of men. And it's so natural to be shut down, actually, and to have all these defenses and barriers. I love that we're different. I love that there is a differentiation in our species, and it creates the possibility for union. So when we take some of those barriers down, it's magic to have two souls sitting there together. And that wouldn't be as magical if they weren't separate to begin with. So there's a great quote that I like, and I think it's Ken Wilber who said it, but he may be quoting somebody else. And somebody asked, why does God incarnate? Like, if God is this complete being, why do we do this worldly suffering business? Why can't God just sit there self-satisfied and not be suffering? And somebody's answer was that it's no fun having dinner alone. We need this interplay of self and other. And I love that it's there. I object to the idea that it will be pushed away. And I don't think that's really possible.
Yeah, we can't ultimately separate ourselves from these core realities. You know, you were saying before that there are some things that maybe would sort of register as controversial to say these are the natural selection processes that we go through in choosing a partner. I'd love to just dive into that, just circle back to that. And, you know, what comes to mind for you when you think about that? And then I guess the second question I have is, why do you think that that's actually important and something that we shouldn't shy away from?
We're qualifying our partners. We kind of put a check in the box on our attraction to them. So you walk into a party, and regardless of your sexual orientation, actually, there are a couple people that you're attracted to who you qualify as potential partners, and then the rest that you don't. And based on that qualification, then we begin to consider whether they're nice or they're cool. But few people will walk over to the person that they're unattracted to and start there. So there are certain ways that women are qualifying men and men are qualifying women. And same for people who are homosexual or transgender, that we start out with some baseline of animalistic qualification based on attraction. And from there, we look at who we vibe with, who's cool. It's like it starts with pheromones. You know, there's something tremendously animal happening in terms of qualifying a partner as potentially interesting, and then looking at personality traits and synergy beyond that. To pretend otherwise is denying cruelty in a really inhumane way that a lot of guys will tell you, oh yeah, it matters a lot. I'm 5'8" and it's not working out. And to the best of my ability, I can't work against this situation. So there are ways that we're still doing this foundationally animal thing with each other, but pretending that we're not. So I insist that we be less humane about it, actually, that we just accept the cruelty of our circumstance, that things aren't fair a lot of the time, regardless, and take it from there. Like, we don't need to BS that all of these values matter above all else, because there are some things that we look for foundationally. Women tend to look for a man's size. That's irrelevant. And then you'll hear that.
What, you've confirmed that across cultures?
I have. Yes, personal anecdotes. Yeah. So the honesty of some women that I've dated, I'm qualified. I am blessed to have a large body. And it's silly if I can't get my emotions together or manage my mind well enough to earn money and have a life. But it's still this huge hang-up for a lot of women. And a lot of guys will tell you that too. I'm comfortable making a generalization there, that women in large part want tall men. And guys are a sucker for the hourglass. It's like we can't get around it. We can't get over it. I guess we're not supposed to.
Yeah, there's something biologically relevant about it, you know, the ability to bear a child, for example. So it makes sense. But this is a really interesting point that you're touching on. The way that we've shied away from truth in its kind of most in its most sober form, because we're trying to be more compassionate or progressive and evolved in these other ways, and what actually happens in the process of that is we're walking around denying reality, which doesn't really serve any of us. And so I'd love you to just to kind of go deeper into that observation and that commentary.
I think we're at a place where our biology just applies less. And when we go to choose a partner, suddenly our instincts kick in. But in terms of how we meet society, our capabilities apply much differently now. And I see women as being very suited to a leadership role currently. That if women are wired for empathy, if they have a greater awareness of circumstantial surroundings, and there's some research to that end, then you may have a square place in the boardroom. Absolutely. Yeah. And what you're talking about is progressivism, denying our humanity in service of humanism. It's really weird. It's like, we just can't make everything fair for everyone. And I absolutely insist that everyone get to be their authentic self and express their gender however they want. But it's really hard to accommodate everyone at the same time. So what happens naturally is that we default back to what's normative and what's thematic. And some of that is based on biology, for sure. But it's really difficult to keep people from doing the normative thing over and over, or to try to design a society that fits everyone. It ends up fitting no one. And there's this simmering displeasure with that, where we get people who are very willful and violent coming out the edges. There's like ideology that's brewed in the, there's ideology that brewed pretty stinky in the Obama era, where that was like the peak of lead from the front progressivism. And then boom, we have a big pushback in terms of hateful beliefs and identities that are really rigidly structured and in opposition to people.
So like a pendulum, you see it as a pendulum that has had to swing in order to balance itself right to the sort of the extreme other side.
Huge pendulum. Yeah. And now a lot of people think it should swing back to the 1950s. That women really should get back in the kitchen and embrace their soft femininity. And men need to do this warrior vibe and go conquer or whatever. And I don't think that meets reality very well. Not now, not then exactly, though I guess there were some benefits in ways that was working out.
The statistic around like it actually not serving women, when you look at the metrics, they weren't living as long in the context of marriages, maybe not, you know, as empowered or as happy. That, yeah, I think is a really important thing to consider in this, that although there's value to embracing these biological truths, that it doesn't necessarily have to look like a picture of the 1950s in order for us to get back there.
No, it doesn't even need to look like monogamy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are all sorts of ways to structure society, structure connection. And there's no reason that a partnership shouldn't benefit both parties. There's no reason that a woman shouldn't be happier and live longer, feel more contentment with a male partner. Mm. Absolutely. But culture, such as it has been for the last forever, like this for the last, 3,000 years, has, or maybe the last 50, has been that women have been better off single and they're happier. Levels of happiness, length of life are longer. Exposure to violence is lower if they're not partnered, because a lot of violence is domestic. Yeah, but there's no reason that partnership and connection wouldn't work out for them foundationally. Like, no. Yeah. Being in connection with someone is beautiful, and it's impossible to prevent us from doing that. We're going to continue to seek relationship for sure. And maybe even making babies.
Hopefully enough to replenish the earth or other worlds. Speak to your thoughts on the structure of monogamy, sort of broadly, historically, now, how you see that.
Any way that people want to arrange their relationships is cool, as long as they're being honest and open. I don't think there's a right way or a wrong way to do that. I know that non-monogamy is super popular now, especially like in Silicon Valley. Like you have to come out of the closet as being monogamous. Yeah. Yeah, you have to come out of the closet as being monogamous in San Francisco. And there's no right way or wrong way to do it. There's evidence. I haven't read much. I haven't read much about gender. I haven't read much about anthropology, but I know that there's some evidence of pair bonding in all societies. Pair bonding has been a theme for people, but it doesn't always mean sexual monogamy. So we're just wired to cheat. We're wired to either do the serial monogamous thing where we're with one partner after another, or have like a loose constellation of relationships where we have pair bonded with someone. Personally, I'm structured kind of for monogamy, and it's just what I grew up with. It's my cultural origin. And I compare that to continuing to like the music that I liked in high school and college and just kind of being like, you know, screw the rest of it. I like what I like and I am what I am. So for me, monogamy feels organic, but it's just based on my conditioning and it's based on the last 50 years of culture. It's not foundational. It's not fundamental to humans.
Have you experimented with that to see like where your real preferences are and edges are?
Thought experiments, yeah. And I've dated people who are polyamorous. Didn't bother me at all. So I don't have this wildly jealous streak inside me. But so far as opening up a relationship with a partner who I was coupled with primarily, I haven't done that. Can I ask if you've played with it?
I don't think I'd have the time, honestly, to be poly.
Good
but
point.
I mean, I definitely one relationship is enough. But you know, I do tend to agree, and this has come out of my own experiences. Like, I definitely come from a more conservative family, and I grew up kind of believing that one partner, you know, is the way. And my parents have been married for. They've been married for like 40 years, I think, but they've been together for like 55 years or 54 years. So, I mean, that was modeled to me very deeply, even though, you know, they had their issues and I think probably got divorced many times. Like, to see two people stay together, irrespective of the difficulty, I think has a subconscious impact on you that runs pretty deep. But I've had my own experiences of loving someone so deeply and not being able to make a relationship work. And I think that really changed my perception of relationships in general, because what I had to find in that experience was my own sovereignty. And that really, like, healing from that and the healing journey of that relationship broke any dogma that I had around sexuality, sexual orientation, preferences, structure of relationships. I think, like, when you've loved so deeply and your heart's been so broken and then you put yourself back together, for me, what I've come to realize for myself is there's no frame, and I feel like I live in accordance with some of the things that you're putting forward, or I try to, which is to just be my authentic self. And these are once upon a time would have been very difficult conversations to have. And if having these conversations now with my partner, like, I'm very honest. If I feel like I am thinking about, you know, wanting to have sex with other people or whatever, I'll just name it. And it's, you know, I haven't acted on that, but I wouldn't not act on it either if I really felt that that was my truth, you know? Like, I would want to follow that because I don't want to live a life that is constraining me. But that was a very unique set of experiences that kind of got me to that point. And I think if I hadn't had those experiences, I would be stuck in a more traditionalist view of relationships.
Yeah, we have to honor our biases.
Yeah.
I got to roll with it. You know, I'm stuck with the music from high school and college because it's what I like, and what I like is what I like. So I really honor that intention you have for authenticity and translate that as honoring bias in certain ways that, yeah, what you condition to like is what you like, and that's actually what you like.
So yeah, to own that and to not be kind of, you know, trying to run away from that. Or I also think, like, we do have a like, one of the contradictions I had to reconcile inside of myself was either, you know, believing that one person could be it all or believing that one person couldn't be it all. Like, that was kind of a real back and forth in me, like an inner conflict. And where I feel like I've come to is I do believe one person could be it all for me, but also they don't have to be, you know. So, like, if I find someone that is it all, that's amazing. But also if I have a partner that maybe doesn't tick every single box. I also don't need to be constrained by that. Like, I can still honor the needs that I might have that they're not able to meet. I think that it, yeah, like, I agree with you in many ways. It doesn't have to be so black and white. I think it's sort of, you should always look at relationships in the context of your life. Like, I have a life right now that's devoted deeply to what I'm building, and having a relationship that's very steady and secure is something that's very nurturing for me. Whereas once upon a time in my life, I wanted something very different. And it's not that one situation is better or worse for me. It's more like contextual to where I find myself. When I want to become a parent, you know, I might want something completely different. Like, I personally want to have children organically. Like, I don't want to go through any kind of artificial process of having children. So as someone that's been in same-sex relationships, for a lot of girlfriends have been like, what the fuck? But that's just me. Like, I believe in the evolutionary truth. I believe that if I'm meant to have children, I'll find a guy that I'm meant to have kids with, and that will just happen. Like, I see it more animalistically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're separating whatever that romantic drive is from the procreation drive.
Like, not necessarily, right? It could be both, but it also doesn't have to be.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe I'm misinterpreting too, or absolutely correct me. But leaning towards same-sex relationships and then also doing the biological procreation thing at one point. That's interesting to hold that dichotomy. That's something.
Like, it's not necessarily either or. In my mind, it's not like I will definitely have a girlfriend and I will also, you know, find a mate that I want to biologically have a child with. Like, I believe that it will happen the way that it's meant to happen as long as I'm authentic to myself. That might be a male that I'm romantically interested in. It might not be. But I also don't have the expectation. And I think that that's been something very freeing, you know. And I think I want that freedom for a lot of people that I see are very constrained in kind of traditional ideas that they have to find this one person and it has to look this way. And I just think that, like, there's a thousand ways it could look, and you got to get more busy living your life. For me personally, like, yes, I've had more female partners and I have had male partners, but I definitely don't see my sexual orientation as black or white.
Mm-hmm. That's fluid to a degree. And our relationship structure too. You might want to do one thing now, another later. I think polyamory is a tremendous discipline. I think you probably learn a lot about communication and empathy and jealousy and boundaries in polyamory.
Mm-hmm.
And monogamy is really interesting too, to limit your palate, so to speak. There's a lot of creativity and exploration in that too.
Yeah, for sure. So when you sort of think about the future of humanity, what's your kind of deep prayer for some men and women in the future?
I'd love to believe in ever upward progress and that we're going to sustain ourselves really well and be more comfortable and better accommodated by whatever our circumstances are. And in that case, we just do a finer and finer tuning of whatever that dynamic is, where I see less gender differences as we evolve. If we reach collective really high levels on our developmental chart, then there's very little place for extreme gender differences in our expression as men and women across the 80% of heterosexual cisgender people. There's not a lot of reason for that if we're all fat and happy. If for parts of the world that are struggling, there's probably more hierarchy and differentiation between men and women and more struggle if they're really trying to keep themselves fed.
And in the context of you then sort of believing that we will evolve in a direction where those lines become more and more blurred, would your hope be that we find a way to maintain the sort of distinctions between masculinity and femininity?
I think it's inevitable. A lot of spiritual traditions talk about that, or that you can't ascend spiritually without some definition of other in the other partner, in the other realm. But our conception of ourself becomes a lot more flexible, and we're less constrained in our ego, and we begin to see our personhood more as a role that we're playing. We begin to see ourselves as more of a construct. So the connection that happens between two partners becomes much more superficial, almost, that it is a decadent level to have reached, and it's really fortunate to be taking off the gender masks in one sense, at least in one level of development, and then experimenting with putting them back on, and experimenting with roles of who's giving and who's taking in any moment, who's leading, who's following, who's doing this yin-yang push-pull stuff that happens throughout nature all the way down to an atomic level. Yeah, so I am hopeful that that will occur and that we can have a really high vibration between our gender differences rather than this crude role play that happens prior to progressivism and prior to everybody being adequately fed. Yeah, I just keep coming back to that.
Well, I think that there's merit in what you're saying, right? Because it speaks to a society that's become so comfortable. And that comfortability takes us away from the primitive urge. I mean, I really personally, in my own way, really relate to almost all the things that you've shared. Like, I feel like I'm pretty in touch with my primal nature and have never kind of fit inside society's frame for that very reason, because I can't deny, like, not even for like 30 seconds in kind of like small talk or a polite conversation, like I can't even find the will to like do that for even a very small amount of time. And even as a child, I was always like that. So I've had a very interesting lens on society because of that. I just wasn't able to fit inside those, you know, and that's obviously created, I think, pretty complex and dynamic parts of who I am, because you have to discover who you are. You can't just click into a box and be what society tells you to be. And that's an ongoing exploration.
Yeah, brilliant. I hope that struggle continues for you. That's an admirable struggle. I hope that you continue to feel discomfort.
Yeah. And yeah, you know, I agree with what you're saying too around the beauty of having people, relationships in our lives that hold a polarity and can be a clarifying mirror as a result of sitting on the other side of the spectrum.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see how operable those energies are of masculinity and femininity, and how one can provoke the other. And my countenance can change my partner. I can create a different reaction from someone based on how I'm embodying what I conceive of as masculine and what's socially masculine.
Where do you feel you're at in your personal journey of that exploration?
I feel pretty settled in it. It's nice. Yeah, I can command a lot of power in a gentle way, and that's really adaptive. So I feel that I've met with an identity that pretty well suits whatever's modern and masculine, in that I can communicate forcefully and clearly. I'm still 6'2". Like, this is working out. So, yeah, I feel pretty contented in that. And I believe that whatever is masculine is most adaptive. That men are really adaptable. Whereas women are anchored to their uterus, especially if everyone's living to age 30. Men have this crisis of freedom, where we're not doing that. Our social role is more flexible. And really, flexibility and effectiveness are masculine qualities as I see it.
Yeah. Makes sense. And you feel that that's even true kind of in the modern day for, say, a younger generation of men, that they're feeling a crisis of freedom, and that's the thing that's putting their identity into question?
I think they're getting some pretty hard messages about not being a man, or that masculinity is toxic. They're getting pushed away from their nature in certain sense, that they're commanded to lower their volume, to be less direct, to sit still. These are hard things for an 8-year-old boy or an 18-year-old boy. Yeah. So there are some ways that I feel that I was socialized female growing up in the 80s and 90s, where being pleasing and relational were really important. And it wasn't until like middle school that I got the message that being hard was important, and being tough and bold and protective. Yeah, those messages came later. I was much more led in a relational direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
Boys are in a bind. Boys are screwed at the moment. it's a tough one.
What do you think the number one transformative message would be for, well, maybe not message, but sort of practical change in our society that would enable a return to, you know, their primal nature?
I'd stop telling people what to do, in large part, not having top-down leadership. As long as your behavior isn't directly affecting anybody else, it's kind of a free-for-all, and people are going to leverage whatever resources they have to meet their needs and to get more resources. So not trying to engineer society is one thing that I currently believe is important, to re-embody some certain things, to re-embody that authenticity. But my view may change. I don't know. If you ask me again in 5 years, it could probably shift a little.
Let's do that.
Yeah, I think it's important to have a healthy conception of something thematic for men and women, that it's okay to have some understanding of things that are more masculine-ish and things that are more feminine-ish, but also allow total deviation from that. Like, we don't need to box people in or exclude them either, but it just unfolds that men end up being one way and women end up being another way. And whatever the conditions are of that, whether we're coding software or fighting tigers, whatever that is, it depends. But it seems that we do bifurcate on gender. We do the gender division, regardless of our society.
True. And then last question, what about Daniela? What happened with that relationship? Let's bring it full circle.
Yeah. All right. So I came for a full circle background to Daniela about a year later. And she's an Italian-Colombian woman living in Colombia. So I'm like, all right, I'm footloose. I'll move to Colombia. And then one day before I'm supposed to get on the plane, she says, no, baby, don't come. After I quit my job, sell my car, all this. So that's the first episode of my podcast, if you care to listen to it, is a conversation with her in the park where we met. And lo and behold, about a year after that, I'm in Mexico City. She circles around there. Magic's still there. So here I am. Here I sit in Colombia once more pursuing a relationship with her. But we're very different creatures. And if you want to hear that conversation, my podcast is titled Polarity Unscripted. PolarityUnscripted.com will get you there. And it's my favorite episode by far. Like, just, it just comes across as so personal. And there's parts where I'm obviously hurt. And it describes our romantic excitement in this delicious way.
We can put all those links in the show notes, so it's there if you guys are listening and you want to check it out. And what are the other ways that our listeners and community can support you Jack or connect with the work that you're doing?
Yeah, this project's a tangent. So I am not like a gender specialist. There will be a book someday. It's been really personal and just fascinating to talk about it. But I'm a relationship coach, and you can learn more about that at polarityunscripted.com. The two are related, but yeah, we're way off topic to get into that.
Yeah, well, these guys will check it out, and I'm sure as they engage more and more with your content, they'll start to be able to see what it's all about. But Jack, I've loved this conversation. We've gone down, you know, many interesting corridors, and hope to circle back in the future. But thanks for coming on the Global Affair.
Thank you.